My name's Charlie Roberts. I'm a fourth year pharmacy student at the University of Nottingham. And for the last year, I've also been the student ambassador for the Institute of Health Promotion and Education. So we're going to deliver a webinar today based around the wider determinants of health. I'll just wait a few more minutes before we get started to actually just make sure that all the participants have joined and have the opportunity to join.
My name is Robin Landsman. I'm a trustee of the Institute, and I'm also an osteopath, allied healthcare professional, and have worked in different public health settings and environments. And I'll mention that more later as we chat. So very interested to see how today goes. And my other colleagues on the committee are coming up next. So Sylvia, do you want to go next?
Yes, I'm Sylvia Cheetah. I'm the current honorary treasurer for IHPE, and I am a past president. My professional background was in public health, with a particular focus on dental public health and nutrition and settings-based approach. And I've been involved with IHPE for probably 20 years.
Thank you,
Karen?
Sylvia.
Sorry.
Yeah,
And
I can
if you
go.
could,
Yeah.
yeah.
Thanks, Charlie. Yeah, so I'm Karen Neal. I trained in pharmacy. I've worked across hospital and community pharmacy, in pharmacology and public health research and teaching. And I've been involved with the IHPE for about 2.5 years now. I specialised as a pharmacist in health promotion and mental health.
Lovely, thanks, Karen. And then do we have Catherine as well?
Hi everybody. My name's Catherine Whittingham. I'm an associate professor at the University of Nottingham and a board member of the Institute of Health Promotion and Education. I'm the programme lead for a undergraduate BSc in Health Promotion and Public Health, and I'm delighted to see a couple of our students here. I worked firstly as a nurse and more of that when we do the questions, but then worked as a health promotion specialist for 10 years in Nottingham City and saw lots of initiatives that we were involved in setting up, particularly looking at smoking cessation and teenage pregnancy.
That's lovely.
That's
Thank you, Catherine.
Charlie, can I just mention to the audience also this is all being recorded. This
Yeah.
production, this program. So it will be shared. And obviously, if anyone's tuning in and wants to share it with other students and other people they know, it will become available. So just to let everyone know that. So I guess thanks for the introductions and thanks, Charlie, for introducing as well. I think probably the next step maybe would be for some clarity and explanation, a little bit more behind your motivations of wanting to do this for students. I think that's really, really important. And also then about the wider determinants of health. What does that really mean? Because I know it's a term that's bandied about, but I know people go a little bit glazed or a little bit blank. They're not sure what it really, really means. So perhaps
Yes.
you could, give a little bit of
That's
thoughts
great,
on that.
Robin. Thank you. Absolutely. So the reason I wanted to do this webinar today is that I grew up in an area called Cheshire, and I worked in a pharmacy in a town close to Cheshire called Ellesmere Port. And it was the first time I'd worked in a healthcare setting. And one of the things I noticed, Ellesmere Port does have pockets of deprivation, and the pharmacy I worked in was in a very deprived area of Cheshire. And it was one of those things, perhaps, where I had a bit of naivety about the extent of how deprivation can impact on people's health and well-being. And working in that pharmacy facilitated me the opportunity to actually experience and see firsthand the extent of deprivation that can occur in places that are just around the corner from me that I'm not necessarily aware of. So that's where sort of my interest began when thinking about sort of health inequalities and thinking about the bigger picture of that. And coming on to this diagram now we've got here, this sort of encompasses those constitutional factors and those wider factors that can impact on somebody's health that may come from a deprived area or deprived background. So I'll quickly talk through this diagram now just to make sure we're all sort of on the same page of what the wider determinants of health actually means. So when we're thinking about the wider determinants of health, we sort of have this onion-shaped diagram that quite nicely encapsulates the sort of picture and image of how health inequalities arise and where, outside of the healthcare setting, where does health inequality actually aspires from. So at the centre of the diagram, we've got those constitutional factors, and those are things that we can't change about ourselves. So think about age, sex, and sort of sex-related diseases and age-related diseases. That's sort of like your genetic makeup that predisposes you to certain conditions. And then outside of that, we've got your lifestyle factors. So choosing to smoke, choosing to drink, and all those sort of factors, those can then modulate your health. And then outside of that bubble, you've then got your social networks and your community networks. And this sort of eclipses and snaps on to sort of like your mental health and who you surround yourself with and sort of your social bubble. And those, like, forming healthy relationships is an important part of being able to actually live a healthy lifestyle as well. And then we get to this sort of green ring here, and it's the World Health Organization predicts that anywhere between 30 and 55% of health outcomes are related to this green ring. So quite a substantial component. And what you can see here is it's actually things out, healthcare services just forms one component of that. But we've actually got these wider conditions about people's livelihood, such as their housing conditions and their sort of sanitation and the sort of food that's available to them, their educational backgrounds and their working environments all have a significant impact on the subsequent health of that person. And then this, in essence, just shows you that as you expand further out, you have these wide influences on your health. So those, in essence, that is the picture of the wider determinants of health.
That's really useful. Very useful diagram. Thank you, Karen, for finding it. And also, I think Charlie explained it really, really well to make it clearer, because I now get it better as well. So that's really cool. So, Charlie, I know we discussed coming up with five questions to ask the panel and to have as a conversation, really, rather than, you know, big long pieces, just a chat amongst ourselves, sort of thing that everyone else can share. And also inviting people to ask questions, either based on the questions we're going to pose on the next few screens, there's five, and or other questions that arise from the audience. Yeah, so we'll handle those perhaps at the end or perhaps during. It just depends how things flow and when people decide to put in their questions. So do you want to launch the first question, the firework?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so my first question for the panel is, what sparked your interest in health promotion?
Who do you want to ask first?
Karen, if you would like to get the ball rolling, that would be great.
I'd love to. Thank you, Charlie. So we have talked about this together and have parallel experiences. For me, the initial observation and shock that I often mention was the discovery of a fast mover shelf in community pharmacy. And basically, it's stock of the drugs that were going out most often to make it efficient. And the three that really stick in my mind were analgesics, antihypertensives, and antidepressants. And as a young pharmacist, wondering why so many people were on those medicines. But the same as yourself, my first locum was in a deprived area of Liverpool, in inner city Liverpool. And we had, or at least 10 methadone users, and that was quite shocking to see so many. I hadn't experienced that before, so very much like yourself. And in community pharmacy as well, I mentioned I had a research interest in pharmacology, and I emerged from university very focused on the science and on the medicines, but out in the real world, so to speak, I began to see the impact of lifestyle, of stress on health and disease, and became interested working with undergrads, actually looking at how we teach clinical nutrition to pharmacy students. And gradually my interests broadened then from the pharmacology into wider public health.
Yeah, that's
really interesting. Sorry, Charlie, I'm chipping in just to who would like to go next and comment or add their sort of input? Yeah, Sylvia.
Yeah, my first job in public health in the NHS was with community dental services. And I've always said that dental health is actually straightforward. If you've got access to a dentist, if you use a fluoride toothpaste, if you have a healthy diet, your teeth are going to be okay for 95% of people. But the reality is, particularly the area that I worked in, and that actually included Ellesmere Port, Charlie.
Of golly.
And the north end of Birkenhead, that I had a really rude awakening, because when I was in the clinics and I used to do various training things with dental students, etc., it's all very well telling a patient that they should be eating more healthily, but if you live in an area where you cannot buy any fruit or veg, because there isn't a fruit or veg shop, and it's quite a deprived area, it's very difficult to adopt those sort of healthy behaviours. So although people do need to change their behaviours in order to maximise on their health, it's absolutely pointless not looking at the bigger picture around them. And that really influenced my practice as working within community dental services, because we have to look where our patients are and the lives that they lead, not just tell them that you need to do this and this, and then your teeth will be fine.
Yeah, you made a really good point there, Sylvia, as well, talking about the accessibility to food and things like that. Because some people who perhaps attend sort of dental services or go to their pharmacy or whatever healthcare setting they may be in, they may actually perhaps be reliant on perhaps food banks as well to sort of acquire what they need. And maybe you can't necessarily get the full nutritional contents of what you need in your diet from those type of places. So it's sort of actually thinking about those other facets of health that we can sort of ensure patients are advocated for and that we educate them on, so that they can actually increase their prospects of their health as much as possible.
Yeah, I think there's something, if you go back into the original Ottawa Charter that informs everything that as health promoters we do, there's a phrase somewhere that says about making the healthy choice the easy choice. I think that still stands today. If it's too difficult, people won't do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Catherine, do you sort of have any sort of, what's your interest in health promotion and what's its relevance to your practice?
Well, I started off in the 80s as a nurse working very reactively, I would say, in the health service, and you know, still very passionate about nursing and what's going on. But after training and qualifying, you know, you become very clear that you are working reactively with a lot of people who've got lifestyle related conditions. Now, that was in the sort of 80s and 90s, and I think you know, where we are now, it's much more significant, and I think acute services, both in mental and physical care, are firefighting all the time. So many people with low level mental health that we could be addressing in a much more positive way are just falling through the gaps. So I suppose I went into health promotion in the 90s, really, because I wanted to see it from the other end. So I actually trained as a nurse and worked with cancer patients at end of life, but wanted to go right back to the start to look at what was going on, and was privileged really in that period to be in the health promotion specialist service as part of the NHS. So we were a big service looking at behaviour change, training, healthy schools. Lots of people sitting here will be nodding, because these are things that we've seen come and go. I hope we may be seeing them come again, because I think there is increasing recognition that we do need to look at working proactively. So I've always been quite passionate about advocating for people, whether that be as a nurse or as a health promotion specialist, looking at why it being much more complex than people just being told you need to do X, Y, and Z. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of that is what you can do in an acute situation. But we recognise as health promotion and public health experts that it's more complicated about that. And it is that wider determinants that will make people's choices more challenging.
Thank you, Catherine. And I think the smoking cessation service is a great one as well, because when we think about core 20 plus five, that sort of outlines the key five areas of health inequalities in society. And smoking cessation has been proven to positively impact those five areas of health inequalities. So again, it's a really important service. It's a great pharmacy service as well, the nicotine replacement therapy. really important to impact patients and sort of get them off smoking as well. Thank you, Catherine. So Robin, if you could tell me about your interest in health promotion as well.
I think what this is sparking in me is very much the launch pad of qualifying in a health profession. I think what's interesting about you now being a fourth year and talking about even me, you know, when I qualified when I was 22, I just realized that out there, the osteopath, being an osteopath for the last 34 years, it was interesting at the beginning. We had these skills, we'd done all these things, and then we had to go out and actually talk to people, a bit like sharing information about health on any level we've been just talking about with the other people speaking. But actually, osteopathy as a concept and as a modality of care was something much more unknown than it is now. And so for me, it was very much about going and speaking and presenting the topic of osteopathy as a choice for GPs, hospitals, doctors, to actually start actually utilizing, you know, something that was fairly new, not completely new, but fairly new to many people. And indeed, that's something that got me into this idea about signposting and providing a different tranche of choices for people, choices to make in their healthcare and what might be more suitable, more applicable, more appropriate for them and their needs. So that was the beginning. And I think it's always been there in me. And I think it's interesting just getting to that point. It's not enough just to do your training as a health professional. You then suddenly got to go, okay, what am I going to do with this now I've arrived? You know, now I've actually qualified. And I think that's what I'm really interested in this webinar. I'm excited to be involved with it for that reason.
Great. Thank you, Robin. So shall we move on to the second question now? So how and why do we engage and empower patients to take ownership of their health? And what challenges do the social determinants of health present in empowering patients? So anyone on the panel, if there's any thoughts or considerations about that?
If I can chip in with the how and why, because I think yeah. When we were discussing the questions and we've now got the how and why, because if I may just say that I think it's quite important that what does the practitioner health professional get from being involved with this idea of health promotion and health education, as in what's the benefit to their career, to their development, to their job satisfaction, as well as, you know, how do we actually technically go about it? You know, and I think they're two different, well, they are two different questions, very much so for me. So that's not the answer, but that just, I'm interested in the question.
I'm yes. happy to come in there, Charlie.
Yeah, thank you, Karen, yeah.
Yeah, the why, and I think you already touched on it there, Robin, you know, about how it can help our job satisfaction. You know, when we see improvements to patients, to their lives, then it can be very rewarding. An example of a really easy intervention I've been involved in is in health promotion workshops is talking about sleep. And so many people don't realize how long the half-life of caffeine is. And simply limiting caffeine intake from, you know, in the afternoon onwards can have a massive difference in sleep and a massive difference on people's lives. And that's a small, easy one. So that's the why and the how. I think reflecting on this question took me back to the previous webinar we did, how do we talk about health? And one of the things that really came out from health promotion experts that I'm enjoying working with at IHPE is the importance of meeting people where they are. And that could be anything in terms of, you know, their educational level, their religious beliefs, you know, beliefs in general, values, you know, and really connecting with them and meeting with them where they are. And I also practice mindfulness that helps me with this. So it can help have a bit of space from what I think they need to do to really connect them, to empower them. And again, that's another key health promotion principle in the Ottawa Charter that Sylvia mentioned, is in empowering people. So if we can meet them where they are and empower them to make the decisions, then, you know, that can bring about greater improvements to their health.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really good as well. But sometimes when we think about the wider determinants of health as well, there are some sort of barriers there. So think about educational levels and sort of people's understanding of health can sometimes be sort of difficult, and it presents a challenge to healthcare professionals to actually that way they have to overcome that and actually help the patient, not only just in their condition but also in understanding their condition as well.
Absolutely.
Can I just, If I
Sorry,
could
can I
just
just,
chip in,
yeah, go on
well,
then.
one of the principles of osteopathy is about finding health rather than finding disease. So slightly different, you know, way of looking at it. But to me, that's always been quite an interesting concept. Yeah, to help people navigate and find their health.
I think the other bit for me, sort of removing, although I'm a nurse, removing the clinical focus and looking at more as a health promotion specialist. When we did it, a lot of that work was actually going out there and finding what the communities and individuals wanted, and doing that very much the felt need rather than the professional need. And again, that really does sit with a health promotion approach, because often money is ploughed into services that just don't fit what that community need. And I think that's how one of the challenges we face is it takes time. So going and engaging with the people that you're really wanting to try and improve health and well-being can take time, but it's very satisfying when you get it right. And I think that's the sort of structural challenges we face, is being under pressure to achieve and show impact, but actually sometimes engaging and advocating and giving the people you're wanting to work with a voice can take time for many complex reasons. But when it works, it's just very, very satisfying to see.
Sylvia, do you have anything to add?
I'm just reflecting on it. Yes, I mean, there's a fine line between empowering people and telling them what they really should be doing, and that should be avoided at all costs. And you can only avoid that by making sure that whoever you are working with is fully engaged and has ownership, whether that's individuals or communities. So joint ownership is really so important. And as you say, Catherine, there's been so many projects where I would use the word parachute. People parachute in. We've got a pot of money and we're going to make it all much better for these people who are in this sector over here. And we're going to set up a vegetable box service or something. And that isn't actually what people need. What they would need is a shop where they can go make their own choices, that's well stocked, that they can access. But unless you actually engage with your community and give them a voice, it's forever just the professionals parachuting in the solution as they see it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think when we're thinking about challenges as well, that like the obstacles that we face in engaging patients to promote their health, we do live in an era where misinformation is very easily accessible as well, such of online and on the internet. And when I was doing my health promotion workshops with the second year pharmacy students, one of the actual real life things I talked about was how actually misinformation has occurred on very public stages, when it's been quite wrong on people's behalves to do that as well, because it sort of feeds misinformation to individuals who think they're making a right choice about their health, when actually it could be doing the very opposite effect.
It's something, I must say, if I can chip in, I've seen in people who've been told about their arthritis 20 years ago by someone who quite glibly, a professional, told them that they would be suffering for the rest of their life or whatever was put in those terms. And because it was someone who sounded they had, you know, the weight and gravitas behind them, people have lived their life based on that misinformation. And it seemed honest, it seemed what it was at the time. But that review of information, like going to the pharmacist and having a chat about something, casually about something you believed was the truth about your health, and having that sudden, hang on a second, you mean that's not been true for the last X years? That is inspirationally useful for people to have that chance to actually do that. It really is.
Yeah, I mean, if I could just make a quick comment on something I was thinking about before coming onto this panel today, about the role of pharmacists going forward in the future. My generation, we got our information that we could actually believe in from the BBC, from your GP, basically anybody with a white coat, and you would believe what they said. You know, that was it. It was gospel truth. And the generation today have got to deal with a whole new world of misinformation, and they're going to find new and trusted sources. And I would see that pharmacists and that's the way forward, because they are people that you would trust. I mean, I'm not saying we didn't trust pharmacists in the past, but it's more that it is in a different world. And you are individuals who are there within a community. And I think that's going to be a great strength of pharmacists going forward.
I think also getting some synergies together with other professionals, and that's why I love being on the board, mixing with all these other people, is the fact that getting people to be on the same page about things and not having conflicting advice, because that's sometimes very, very confusing for patients when they hear different views and different ways forward. So I've just been reminded also that people who are listening can chip in questions. There's a button at the bottom of your screen for the people who are watching, and you can actually send in a live question now using that Q&A button. So I just encourage people to do that if you'd like to throw in a question for the panel. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's great. Thank you, guys. So we'll move on to, if we don't have any questions from any, we've got one from Rebecca Smith. Is there a central hub to access health promotion materials that things?
I'm sorry, I'm afraid I can't do that.
Okay.
I can pick this up, Charlie.
Yeah, that's great if you take it.
Yeah, there are various sources of information, and obviously the one I'll list first is the Institute for Health Promotion and Education .org. Is that correct? We can provide links. That there's a lot of resources on there. We write position statements, consultation responses. We write in the British Medical Journal. And there's also, for pharmacy specifically, information through the Royal Pharmaceutical Society. There is a community pharmacy body, Community Pharmacy England, the Pharmaceutical Journal, and of course NHS England provides information about health promotion and extended pharmacy services.
There's also the All Our Health, which is part of Public Health England, which are excellent. So you may, as a pharmacy student, certainly our nursing students and health promotion students, you log on to e-learning for health. They do a lot of mandatory packages, but they also have got a specific platform for something called All Our Health, and they've got lots and lots of very interactive resources that you can look at, but also take you to all the evidence-based links. The best thing about those resources, if you join the platform, which is obviously free, is that they update them. So there's things like county lines, there's childhood obesity, there's air pollution. I mean, Charlie, if you're nodding, if you've seen them, there's a lot. Smoking cessation, you know, teenage sexual health, that sort of thing. But it means that if you're a member of that platform and you go into All Our Health, if you've got a specific topic you're wanting very robust information on, that's a really good starting point, I would say.
And if I can just chip in also, I worked for Westminster Library Service, and we had a lot of work going on in libraries. We ran events using some of the material that Catherine just mentioned. They ran events, we supported the events, and we got in a lot of people in the population who would just drift into a library thinking it's just the library and that's what it is, and they'd have health conversations with us about a whole list of topics. I mean, in fact, this was all published by Public Health England on the project we actually did. But it was very, very revealing, and getting conversations going with people who they wouldn't go and see the doctor about it, or they wouldn't even go and see the osteopath or anybody about it. But we were having those conversations, very, very interesting, very useful. So got a couple more questions coming in.
I was going to say, quite a few.
Sorry, Catherine. Charlie, do you want to handle, there's about three more, four more questions come in.
Since we've been chatting. Yeah, you want me to read them out, or?
You can read the first, we can just. Yeah.
Okay, so question by Beth Laidlaw: is health promotion equally applicable to a pharmacist who works in the community compared to a pharmacist who works in industry? So health promotion can be integrated into sort of any healthcare professional's practice. I think the scale of health promotion would be different for one who works in industry compared to one who works in community. I'm sure Karen could perhaps give more insight than I, but I guess in my opinion, the health promotion aspect of working in industry would entail on your working environment, your working dynamic, making sure you're working sort of actually the workplace, because admittedly, you won't have as much patient interaction, but you're still developing those medicines. You need them to be ethical. You need them to be safe. You need to make sure that they're sterile and they're manufactured safely. So thinking about it in that respect, if as a pharmacist in industry doing that, you're promoting the health of patients, just not on a face-to-face level. Whereas a pharmacist in the community has that direct patient interaction to promote the health. So health promotion, I'd say, is equally applicable, just in different contexts. I don't know if Karen wants to add anything to that as well.
Yeah, I completely agree, Charlie, and would perhaps broaden it a little bit more and bring Ottawa, the Ottawa Charter back in. And something IHPE advocate for strongly is health promoting settings. And so workplaces benefit from moving towards being health promoting settings. Then that also benefits the health of the workforce and the pharmacists themselves, which is obviously also important. So any branch of pharmacy, you know, is applicable to that.
That's great. Thank you, Karen. So another question is, as a pharmacist, I'm interested in how you think we could get to the hard to reach deprived populations that Charlie mentioned at the outset. That's a really good question. So in my opinion, I think reaching deprived populations, deprivation is a very broad and generic term. It depends in what context the individual is deprived. For example, are they deprived in education? Are they deprived in economically? And depending on that that context of deprivation would mediate the action that needs to be taken. When I was sort of making my health promotion workshops, I was doing some research around the background of sort of educational understanding of people's of ailments. And what I found is that people sort of an Afro-Caribbean heritage compared to white people were less aware of the signs and symptoms of colorectal cancer. And they're a population that are more likely to acquire colorectal cancer over their life course. So the fact that they haven't had the opportunity to be educated on that, or haven't had the same opportunity as everybody else, means that it sort of impacts on their health and understanding of their health. So I think it's a case of where the deprivation occurs, how do we target that deprivation, basically. So that was one example I could think of. I don't know if anyone else got any other suggestions.
Well, I think if I can chip in just on health champions, quite a few local authorities run health champions. So in fact, I was working with a group on osteoporosis, women of Asian backgrounds. And so they invited me to speak. And to be honest with you, there were 24 of them, they share into their community directly that information. So it's almost like a cascade process. And that seems quite a powerful way to actually connect into more people and get more ears listening to people they trust in their own community. So that was a very thoroughly good program as an example.
The other thing I think about is, and I hope it stays the same, but a lot of services are now virtual, and that's really important for people about access and transport issues. But I think at the moment, your community pharmacies are often in a physical community. And I think that again comes back to health promoting where we're living. And I think they could become a really positive hub, because clearly you'll have some community pharmacy buildings in very deprived areas that might be surrounded by other infrastructures. And increasingly, we all know it's difficult to get some face-to-face services, but probably people will still physically go in to the community pharmacy. So it's, to me, maximizing that in those deprived environments. And there are examples of that in the past where people have got drop-ins in the pharmacy for welfare benefits, housing advice, you know, affordable warmth. If you're really pushing your boundaries, you might have some sort of service there where people go for refreshments and keep warm. If we're looking at fuel poverty, issues around period poverty, your community pharmacy could actually become almost like a healthy living centre that we've had in the past, because I hope they won't become virtual all the way. I mean, there might be virtual consultations that are great, but actually I feel that people still physically go to the community pharmacy as well.
Yeah, I agree with that, Catherine, and I think the community pharmacists have got a real opportunity. They know their community. Quite often, certainly in this area, they will be next to part of joined onto the GP surgery, which will also have people like link workers looking at the non-medical health issues of the patients. And if the pharmacist, you know, there's a question a bit further on here, I think, about who you can collaborate with. Well, there's wonderful opportunities there to network and to think beyond the box of pills for the patient that's in front of you. I would think the pharmacist, you know, knows that the families with lots of asthma going on who are not in good housing, you know, they have an opportunity not just to, you know, help support that family with their prescriptions, etc., but to feed into wider things that are going on in the community around things like housing and access to outside spaces.
I was involved, funnily enough, with a theatre project a little while ago that produced a production that was all about this community aspect to health. And it was one of the most wonderful plays I can say I've ever seen. And it incorporated all these aspects that Sylvia's just mentioning about housing, about all sorts of concepts. And the conversations through the play brought up topics and made it an amazingly useful piece of work, actually, to talk about all sorts of things about health and not isolating it to, I mean, someone's actually brought up a question, Christina Benson. I don't know if that's maybe on topic now. Charlie, if you can see that question, I think we...
Yeah, that would be great. So Christina asked, would you please share an example of a successful health promotion programme and explain why you think it was successful and how it accounted for the wider determinants of health?
Well, I guess my example kind of is what I was looking
Sorry.
For
there.
Could I just come in before we move on? Because it's just something I feel so passionately about, and I'm really pleased that this has come up about community pharmacy being in the heart of all these communities, because we are seeing reports of a lot of them closing, and it's just vital that we need to protect this. So I just wanted to, you know, get that in there that, you know, we really need to protect those services and how valuable they are.
There is a question before the next one. So I don't know if you want about the occupational therapists.
So what role can occupational therapists play in health promotion for their clients?
That was Roberta Ramos.
Yeah.
So I don't know if anyone, but I just think about sort of the rehabilitation role that occupational therapists play a really important part in. And for me, it's again looking at the interventions that often get ignored. So when I was working as a community nurse, people who had reduced mobility living with long-term conditions, the first thing would be put a stair lift in. But we now know there's lots of evidence about strength training, balance. It's looking at health promotion across the lifespan as well. So we do think a lot about prevention, but actually, you know, health promotion goes up to and includes end-of-life care. And it's looking at advocating for not going necessarily down the line of all the adaptations, which obviously occupational therapists is a lot of work goes on with that, but thinking again wider in your own profession about differing interventions to look at sort of the health promotion initiatives in the context of your clients. So I hope that sort of addresses it a little bit, but I do think sometimes we go down that route of almost reducing people's independence because it's often the quicker fix in a way, and we can show what we've done. Whereas if you do, 6 month strength training, it's about will that have reduced that person's risk of falls? And that's always the challenge we face in health promotion and public health, is how we show impact, because sometimes it's a null effect you want. So you don't want the person to fall over.
But I think it's also individualizing the advice and care. I think very much, you know, there are different people who are at risk of different things, but it's a matter of having those conversations and finding out exactly how that individual ticks. And it might be the stairlift example is a good one, that depending totally on the stairlift stops all walking upstairs ever happening. And perhaps some of the time that might be quite good for someone's health to get some strength, you know. So it's a fine line. And I think occupational therapists can have, I coached an occupational therapist actually in the detail of the conversation that they were having with their clients, with their patients. That was the essence of what they were bringing to the patient. I think that made it particular and focused.
This is where positive health indicators could be really helpful and something I know we advocate for as well, and move away from the, you know, how many falls there've been and the negative impact and morbidity, mortality and so on. I'm also reminded of, you know, when I was training, the use of high dose antipsychotics and, you know, hypnotics in elderly people was often easier. And thankfully, we've moved away from a lot of that sedating practice. And the other thing that came to mind about OTs, if they have an enormous role in special educational needs and disability, which is an area of interest of mine. And actually, they could be used a lot more, I think, from what I've seen in that area.
And Rebecca just asked, I'll just mention it because it's from Rebecca Smith was on earlier. But in fact, yes, those from the Public Health England campaigns, you can download total campaigns. In fact, they give you the whole package, that, you know, the cards, the postcards, the whole thing comes down with the posters as well on that topic. So that's it's all there once you sign up, I think Catherine was saying. And we've signed up as well. So you get all that stuff sent to you every month or two, which is helpful. And we've got another question as well, Charlie.
Just in the interest of time, should we move on with the question? Yeah, because I've just realised the clock's ticking away a little bit. So maybe if we crack on with the questions on the slides, and then if we've got any time left over at the end, we'll answer these two questions. Okay, perfect. If I could have the next slide, please.
Charlie, just to say, we could follow up afterwards in a follow-up email with answers to further questions. Some technical difficulties, I think, are happening with the slides.
Right, no problem.
I think we're on question four, is it? I believe.
So the last question we were on is, how can healthcare professionals collaborate to promote health of patients? And have you had any experience with this in your career?
Well, I think if I give an example, it actually answers the question that was posed about teenage pregnancy.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was in the 90s and funded by Health Action Zone, which came, again, health promotion, public health is always influenced politically by a little p, but we were given funding and we were really privileged to actually have the time to go out and talk to young people in an area of Nottingham with high rates of teenage pregnancy. So the collaboration, really very briefly, was across the NHS about sexual health services, seeing very young people becoming pregnant. You know, we're talking 13, 14 year olds, so we're very young, in a very defined area with high rates of health inequalities. So it came from NHS data, but we went out and spoke to young people in that area. And the immediate, and I always teach this session to the students, but you know, your gut instinct would be there was no services, but actually there was. So there was reasons why young people wouldn't go to that service, and that was why it was really important that we spoke to them. And then they wanted a service in the youth club. So it was actually run as a youth service, but we provided contraception, chlamydia screening, sexual health services in a youth club setting. So that ran across the city council, because it was youth services, and also education and health. The challenge with it is making sure you're all on the same page with what your measurement of your outcomes are, like Karen said. So the health wanted a reduction in teenage pregnancy. The youth services wanted an increase in uptake. So it's making sure that collaboration, everybody is involved from the outset, and really importantly, the young people, and getting it right, because it could have been quite easy to get it wrong. Because as I think Sylvia said, it's about the person's needs and what they see as a priority, rather than what we perceive it to be as professionals.
That's great. Thank you, Catherine. Would anyone else like to add to that?
I could just say that Dr. Janelle DeGrucci, who was one of the speakers of our parliamentary event, spoke very clearly about the need for different collaborations across all sectors. I've been mentioning during lots of the conversation between healthcare professionals and housing and all sorts of youth groups and whatever, so that everybody's starting to talk and see the importance of being on the same page. And I think that is coming. It sounds very much from the top. So I think that's kind of understood as a way forwards, definitely.
Thank you, Robin. Would anyone else like to add to that as well?
I can give a simple example, actually, and you know, meeting and working with Robin, I didn't really understand a lot about the role of an osteopath, if I'm honest. And just a simple conversation about people using anti-inflammatories and perhaps anti-inflammatory gels, Robin explained to me how helpful it is for people to use those medications before they attended appointments to help make the joint easier to work with improved blood flow and reduced inflammation. And that's not something I would have thought of particularly. So that, you know, cross health professional working, I can then, you know, advise patients and Robin's work can be more effective. And then there was also, I didn't realise I'd collaborated with Catherine indirectly quite a few years ago in the community pharmacy, what was then New Leaf, the smoking cessation services that, you know, we were liaising with our, you know, public health colleagues and then rolling this out through the community pharmacies. And that, again, is very rewarding to have, to learn from other health professionals. Yeah.
Thank you, Karen. If you have any final thoughts on that, Sylvia?
I was just thinking of my own role in public health, and it's now 10 years since public health moved back into the local authority. There's a big report out this last week, which I have not read yet. It was always certainly the aspiration, and I think, you know, with all the information I do still continue to receive, it is better because the public health is now within housing, education, the local services, and not outside of it. So I suppose that's on a far more macro level, but the things that affect individuals' health, we need all of those services to be, if not co-located, at least to have real clear and open lines of communication so that they can all work together to the benefit of their local communities.
That's great.
Thank you.
So we'll go on to question four now. What lessons can we learn from the history of the health promotion and the Institute of Health Promotion Education so that the future of health promotion is more effective and robust?
Can I just jump in on that one? A real buzzword for me is evaluation. It's not always easy to evaluate health promotion because what are these outcomes, outputs? And over my very long career, I've seen the goalposts move, you know, quite a few times. And I think one of the important things is to remember at the beginning about evaluation, and it's not it's not an add-on at the end. I can see in the question chat somebody's asked something about how you can help to get money for different things. Whatever we do in health promotion, generally the money for it is coming from the state. And most of the time, if it's not actually a bid, you're still fighting for funding streams from different departments. And if you evaluate things properly, you're more likely to be successful. That was one point. And the other point is the job is never done. So even though you think that everybody knows everything about whether it's sexual health, five a day, the next generation don't know. So I think health promotion, it's never going to be a job that's done. You might have one thing like clunk click, Everybody gets in the car and puts their seatbelt on. Nobody thinks it's not a good idea, but generally most things that have a behavioural change element to them, job is never done.
Thank you, Sylvia. That was very insightful. Does anyone else like to add to that as well?
It just reminds me of, you know, the big part of our role being as advocates, actually, and a big part of IHPE role. And we advocate for pharmacy in the hope that, you know, the resources are there to enable pharmacists to fulfil their potential in this area.
But as we said earlier, I think job satisfaction wise, whether there's extra money, there are little touches that one can offer as part of the day job, which give satisfaction, which give up to the better professional role. You know, so it doesn't necessarily take, I mean, it does take perhaps funding in some respects, but actually I think it's attitude of mind and wanting to have that energy behind what you do and why you do it as a professional. So,
I do, can I just add to that? I've talked about evaluation, but there's also something really important about recording and writing up what you do. She said to just highlight that IHPE has a wonderful international journal that is always looking for papers to be sent in. Because if you're doing something small and might appear local with your community pharmacist, that you are doing something that is around education, around behaviour change, about sharing knowledge, make sure that you evaluate it and you write it up and then it can be shared. So we don't have to constantly be reinventing something and starting from scratch.
All right, thank you. We'll move on to the last question now, which is thinking towards the future of pharmacy practice, what has been successful in health promotion and what more needs to be done so that pharmacists remain an accessible source of health promotion to patient groups and populations?
I could start on that one, Charlie, yeah, which might be predictable as the pharmacist on the panel. I think one thing that hasn't come up so far is the acknowledgement that there are some barriers to pharmacists doing more work in health promotion. A couple of the IHPE trustees, including myself, wrote to the Pharmaceutical Journal about this. And so we've mentioned resources, actually, and education, that there might be, gaps requiring CPD, and also there are legal barriers as well, and these all need addressing urgently, actually, to enable us to do more of this work. And I think the other thing is, this is resources, I think it really needs to be resourced to enable pharmacists to have more consultation time with patients, and that makes such a difference. And we have got the NHS Community Pharmacist Consultation Service, some of which is at pilot stage, and particularly looking at integrating pharmacists into urgent care is a pilot that's ongoing. But again, actually, it does tie into the barriers that are preventing pharmacists from having that consultation role that can be so, so valuable.
Yeah, and I think relating to that, I have worked in a hub and spoke pharmacy before, where sort of the hub was affixed to the spoke pharmacy, and there was a pharmacist in the hub, and it basically just takes them out of the community setting because they're working in the sort of warehouse and the background checking, and it means that they can't actually have consultation, that pharmacists can't have consultations, and it sort of takes a resource away from the public facing setting as well. So I think with the advent of hub and spoke pharmacy, it does present some obstacles as well to health promotion in that way, taking pharmacists out of that public facing role as well.
Wow.
And I suppose I don't speak as a pharmacist, but I think we also have this sort of cultural shift about non-pharmacology. And that not everything, you know, we don't want to treat over-medicate everything. Looking at other initiatives such as like things that we can use as social prescribing, which is interesting that it's given like the language of pharmacy, but actually it's about non-pharmacological management of issues. So I think that's a paper in itself, is about the language we use and why has it got to be seen as something that's prescribed. But I think culturally, you know, we are a society that often does expect to have something that's a quick fix. And again, that's, we have to push against that ethos, but that takes time and it takes energy from the individuals that are often, you know, have got complex needs. So I've seen that as a nurse, but I've also seen that as a health promotion specialist. So I think that is interesting, and that's the challenges pharmacy space as well.
It goes back to also the signposting thing I think I mentioned earlier, is that people who are trusted and members of, you know, like pharmacists, other professionals, people go to them and want to have a signpost. They want a direction and they will follow very much so if they're given the right information in the right way. So it's a shame to lose that opportunity, that touch of connection with people, because that's very powerful if it's done well. So that's kind of, yeah, I mean, I know even going to my own pharmacist and asking questions, there's a big variety of, like there is with every medical professional, health professional, what you get from that pharmacist and how much information you get and how much they check and how much they ask and how much interest they show, how much time they've got. I mean, there's a whole list of factors there, which are, you know, just, I've been testing it out since preparing for this webinar, going to the pharmacist and asking some questions and just seeing where it goes. So I've been doing my little bit of research.
Catherine, it puts me in mind of the pill for every ill, you know, that there is still that to overcome in a lot of people. And just looking, I've got a copy of one of the letters we wrote here to the Pharmaceutical Journal that does a report from the Royal Pharmaceutical Society. And a quote we've taken from that is, by 2030, it is envisaged that pharmacy teams will have essential roles in preventing ill health by taking a holistic approach to care that goes beyond medicines. And it refers to social and green prescribing, as you said, and also referring on to other services. So it's definitely the direction that we're going in. Yeah.
Charlie, I think we might have to say the wrap-ups for today. Yeah. Thank you, everyone. So I'll leave that to you. But yeah, just
yeah, of course. Do that, so thank you for your questions. I fortunately don't think we'll have time to go through all of them now because we are at the last moment. Is there any possible way that the questions could be answered at a later date or anything like that? Or
they could go in a follow-up email, Charlie.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. So I'll make note of those questions and then get the answers for them as well. So sorry about that. But
we've got them. We have got them.
Let's move on to our closing slide as well. It's just a little bit of a
so the closing slide as well now, please. So I'd like to thank all the panel members in particular. So Sylvia, Robin, Karen, and Catherine for giving their time to be a part of this panel today. I really appreciate it and I'm really thankful for it. And thank you for offering your expertise. And thank you so much. And I'd also like to thank the Institute of Health Promotion and Education as well. And I'd also like to thank the University of Nottingham. So thank you all. And it's really been a great session. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Charlie, for putting it forwards.